This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Discover Magazine. Each week, we explore our amazing world through the pages of Discover. From the natural sciences to technological breakthroughs, there is always something new to learn on Discover. Coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Discover Science, and I'm your reader, Brad, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the June issue of Scientific American. Copyright 2025, Scientific American. And now I'll continue with Cosmic Dawn by Rebecca Boyle. The best hope scientists have of understanding the cosmic dark ages is to get away from Earth's radio noise entirely and go to the moon, the ultimate goal for Burns, who has hoped to glimpse this epic of the cosmos from that vantage point for his entire career. From the moon, astronomers can create a pristine map of the universe's early neutral hydrogen. Measurements of the depth and width of the hydrogen signal will reveal the nature of the first stars, how massive they were, how much ultraviolet light they produced, how hot they were, and more. We may never see them directly, but we could see their environments and try to understand what they must have been like, Burns says. Just from the spectrum, we'll be able to infer all those properties about the cosmic dawn, he says. The Lunar Surface Electromagnetics Experiment, nicknamed Lucy Night, will also join the hunt when it launches sometime in 2026. The spacecraft, which is being built by NASA and the U.S. Department of Energy, will ride to the moon onboard Firefly's Aerospace Blue Ghost commercial lander. Once in place on the moon's far side, Lucy Night will use an enormous battery to survive the frigid lunar night, a prime time to listen to the distant dance of ancient electrons. If the mission succeeds, it will be the first lunar cosmology experiment, but not the last, Burns says. He envisions a full-size cosmology telescope on the far side of the moon, built using lunar soil. One proposal, called Farview, calls for constructing networked antennas on the moon by extracting metals and elements, such as oxygen, from the moon dust, and then manufacturing parts on site. On the far side, the moon itself blocks Earth's radio cacophony, allowing those faint 21 cm photons to stand out clearly through the noise. For veterans like Burns, these advances have been a long time coming. Burns gave his first presentation about lunar radio telescope in 1984 at a lunar and planetary science conference in Houston. I never would have thought that it would take 40 years before this would be realized. I feel lucky that I am seeing it in my lifetime, he says. But Burns is also glad to be passing the torch. This is where it starts. We will pick up hints, collect data, refine our instruments, he says. Over the coming years, scientists will fly new missions to the moon, gain more experience, and eventually install the instrument of his dreams. We will eventually crack it, he says, or at least somebody will. Burns takes hope from the young scientists joining the quest now, the students, postdocs, and newly minted professors who will lead the coming efforts. They're the ones who are going to make this happen, he says. It's thrilling to see them understand the sense of discovery that is before them. Refreezing the Arctic by Alec Loon. Researchers are trying to rebuild the disappearing sea ice above the Arctic Circle so it can reflect the sun's warming rays. A haze of ice crystals in the air created a halo around the low sun as three snowmobiles thundered onto the sea ice on a February morning in far northern Canada. Wisps of snow blew across the white expanse. It was negative 27 degrees Celsius as we left Cambridge Bay, an Inuit village, in a vast archipelago of treeless islands and ice-choked channels. This temperature was relatively warm, 6 degrees C above average. The winter had been the mildest in 75 years. The sea ice covering the Arctic Ocean was at its smallest extent on record, Scientists predict that within the next 15 years, this ice cap will disappear in summer for the first time in millennia, accelerating global warming. The UK company Real Ice, whose heavily bundled team was bouncing around on two other snowmobiles ahead of mine, hopes to prevent that outcome with an effort that has been called extremely ambitious, insane, or even dangerous. At a spot 7 kilometers from the village, Real Ice co-founder, Sian Schwerin, an Irishman with a red beanie and a scraggly goatee, hopped off his snowmobile and started drilling with a long electric auger. A gob of water and frozen shavings sloshed up and out of the hole as he punctured the underside of the ice more than a meter below. Inuit guide David Kavana widened the opening with a spear-like ice saw, then placed a wood box around it. Schwerin lowered an aluminum pump, which looked like a large coffee urn, attached to a curved rubber hose through the hole. He plugged a cable into a battery pack. After a few seconds, water began pouring out of the hose, spilling onto the ice in an ethereal shade of blue. As it congeals, the water acts almost like lava, Schwerin said. The ice formation starts almost instantly. Thin, broad sheets of ice expand from the ice cap's edges in winter, when it's dark and cold, and melt away in summer, when the sun shines 24 hours a day. The ice acts like a giant mirror, reflecting up to 90% of the sun's radiation back towards space. Ocean water, in contrast, absorbs 90% of sunlight. The ice cap's core of so-called multi-year ice, which persists year-round, has shrunk by about 40% in 4 decades, kicking off a vicious cycle. As more ice melts, more ocean water is exposed, and that water warms further, melting even more ice. If the ice starts disappearing entirely in summer, global temperatures could rise an extra 0.19 degrees Celsius by 2050. Real ice is trying to thicken seasonal ice so it lasts longer into the warm months, keeping the planet cool. Schwerin hopes pumping could someday refreeze 1 million square kilometers of both seasonal and multi-year ice, an area the size of Texas and New Mexico combined, and about a fifth of what's now left in summer, to stop the ice cap's death spiral. All it would take, Real Ice says, is 500,000 ice-making robots. Polar geoengineering on such an enormous scale could help slow warming until the world finally weans itself off coal, oil, and natural gas. Many scientists think it will never work. The researchers at Real Ice argue we no longer have any option but to try. Studies suggest that even slashing fossil fuel use may not save summertime sea ice. It's sad that it's ended up this way, but we've got to do something about it, Schwerin said to me on the frozen plane. Emission reduction is just not enough anymore. Cambridge Bay, which British explorers named for a 19th century Duke of Cambridge, is a town of 1,800, mostly Inuit inhabitants located across from the Canadian mainland on Victoria Island, one of the world's largest islands. When I landed at the one-room airport on a twin-engine turboprop, I was greeted by a stuffed musk ox and a placard about the 1845 British naval expedition of John Franklin. Cambridge Bay lies along the Northwest Passage, an icy sea route between Europe and Asia, sought by explorers for 400 years. Franklin's two ships, Erebus and Terror, were trapped in the polar sea ice that surges down toward Cambridge Bay in winter, buckling into ridges up to 10 meters high. All 129 men on board died of cold, starvation, or disease. These days, cruise ships coast through the passage every year, often visiting gravesites of Franklin Expedition members. The Inuit call Cambridge Bay Ikolakatikak, meaning good fishing place. For millennia, their nomadic ancestors came here to fish Arctic char, a silvery orange cousin of the brook trout. Inuit started living here full-time in the 1940s and 1950s, when the U.S. military hired them to help build a navigation tower and a radar station to detect Soviet bombers coming over the pole. The Cold War also led to the idea of controlling the Arctic environment. The USSR discussed destroying sea ice with coal dust or explosions and detonated 3 nuclear devices to try to excavate an Arctic canal. In the U.S., physicist Edward Teller's project, Plowshare, nearly got approval to gouge out a harbor in Alaska with atomic bombs. geoengineering today is indeed to cool off Earth and to fend off climate change. Some scientists and entrepreneurs are focused on dispersing sulfate particles in the stratosphere to block sunlight, which could lessen heating but also disrupt global weather patterns, such as the South Asian monsoon. Mexico recently announced a ban on this solar geoengineering after Silicon Valley startup Mike Sunset's launched two balloons full of sulfur dioxide there. The city of Alameda, California, halted an experiment to spray sea salt particles skyward to make clouds more reflective. Field trials targeting the Arctic, the Antarctic, and the third pole of colossal glaciers in the Himalayas have stirred up less controversy, perhaps because unintended consequences would be confined largely to those distant places. In Iceland and India, Silicon Valley nonprofit Bright Ice Initiative has scattered tiny glass beads on glaciers to try to reflect more sunlight and slow the melting. Chinese agencies have blown chemical smoke into clouds with rockets, planes, drones, and chimneys to provoke snowfall over glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau. Researchers in Scandinavia are developing giant curtains that could be anchored to the seabed to block warm ocean water from melting the undersides of ice shelves in Antarctica. Billions of dollars would be needed to affect the climate. The idea for thickening ice came from outer space. At a 2012 conference, a fractious forum about global warming sourced Arizona State University astrophysicist Steve Tisch's hopes for quick climate action. Tisch, who studies icy bodies such as Pluto's moon Charon, wondered whether we could buy time by making ice in the Arctic. The problem is that sea ice freezes from below. Once the first layer forms, it insulates the seawater from the air, which can be 50 degrees colder. The thicker the ice gets, the slower it grows. In 2016, Tisch published a paper proposing that wind-powered pumps could thicken sea ice by pulling up water from below and spraying it across the top. Around this time, students at Bangor University in Wales were inspired by a documentary on the Arctic to construct a re-icing machine, an unimaginably spindle of hoses that twirled like a lawn sprinkle. One of these students was Sherwin. Encouraged by Dusch's paper, he and London entrepreneur Simon Woods founded Retail Ice in 2022 to see whether sea ice thickening could scale up. They eventually recruited Dusch and several sea ice scientists as advisors. The company puts its first water onto ice in Nome, Alaska, in January 2023, ditching the sprinkler for a commercial pump. They move to the Canadian High Arctic Research Station in Cambridge Bay the next year to do more. It's not exactly the same as a natural process, but it's as close as you can get, Dusch says. After the team drilled the first hole that February morning and started to pump, we snowmobiled to a destination pinpointed by GPS several hundred meters away. Again, the group drilled and inserted a pump, and water began whooshing out. In all, we installed four pumps in four places. As water pooled, the edges crept outward, soaking into the pockmarked snow, which was up to 25 centimeters, 10 inches thick, and crusty, like hardened white frosting. Within hours, the pool would coagulate into electric blue slush, like a gas station Slurpee. After a lunch of fruit bars and potato chips around a tiny gas heater in the team's rescue tent, we went to a site the crew had pumped a day earlier. Under a dusting of snow lay flat gray ice, with a drill bit almost as tall as himself. One of the volunteers bored a hole and dropped in a measuring tape with fold-out brass arms at its end. The ice was 152 centimeters thick. Almost 30 centimeters of ice had been added, compared with untouched sites they measured. The ice would thicken further in coming weeks. Because snow is a better insulator than ice, this quality is why igloos work so well. Flooding and freezing the snow could allow more cold to penetrate to the ice underside, creating more ice. After real ice thickened 4,100 square meters of ice here in winter 2023-2024, the crew came back in May 2024 to find a significant increase. Across the area they had pumped, ice thickness was 1.9 meters, compared with 1.44 meters in other places. Ice growth from below, that's really the efficient part, Woods told me as he drilled a measuring hole at another refrozen site. but snow is also a better mirror than ice, which could complicate the picture. Sea ice covered by snow reflects 90% of solar radiation, whereas bare sea ice reflects 50 to 70%. Real ice would need snow to accumulate in spring to replenish the snow it flooded in winter, where the process could increase melting. That's just one way flooding snow could backfire. As seawater freezes, the salt in it's ejected from the ice crystals, leading ever saltier pockets of brine to form on the surface. Salt lowers the freezing point of ice, whether on winter roads or the sea. If pumping seawater leaves more salt on the surface in summertime, it could end up accelerating the disappearance of the ice. So far, this doesn't seem to be happening. On another morning, Woods put a hollow red barrel on the drill and bored into the ice at a refrozen site to extract an ice core about as long and thick as his arm. He held it up to the pale sun, which illuminated hairline channels where the salty fluid had eaten its way through the ice. This natural process helps the brine to migrate back into the ocean, he said. It's still not clear how ice thickening will affect sea life, starting with the microscopic algae that grow on the underside of the ice. They're eaten by zooplankton, which are eaten by fish, which are eaten by mammals. On a different morning, I snowmobiled with University of Alaska Fairbanks marine biologist Brendan Kelly to a low ridge formed by two enormous plates of ice pushing together. A polar science advisor in President Barack Obama's administration, Kelly has studied seals and polar bears for more than four decades. In that time, he's also watched fossil fuel emissions march steadily upward. So despite his discomfort with geoengineering, he agreed to advise real ice. In the hazy light, the monochrome landscape seemed devoid of life. But as we crunched on foot along the snow-cackling ice ridge, Kelly stopped to point out an Arctic fox footprint. Farther on, he found a urine stain, then desiccated green scat, then a small pit. Seal, probably, Kelly said. In spring, ringed seals claw holes through snowdrifts. They hide their fuzzy white pups in these layers while they dive for fish and crustaceans. Foxes and polar bears dig around to try to find the pups. Kelly scooped up the firm snow. Tiny icicles swang from his white mustache, but couldn't find a lair. Polar bears also depend on snow. They excavate dens in larger drifts to warm their cubs, which are born the size of a guinea pig. Most Arctic snow tends to fall in late autumn. It's unknown whether enough new snow would build up after wintertime ice thickening for bears and seals to make dens in spring. Of course, polar bears and seals are already expected to decline as their sea ice inhabitant melts away. Is real ice doing more harm than good by pumping seawater into this environment, melting the snow? We don't know that, Kelly said, but we need to know it. Across 2 months last winter, real ice pumped water through almost 200 holes. Drills and snowmobiles broke, team members got frostnip, and Arctic foxes chewed through long, thin thermistor cables used to measure temperature in the snow and ice. The researchers thickened 250,000 square meters of ice. The ice cap is losing 300,000 times that area every year. The key to scaling up is to bring the engineering underwater, Sherwin told me later. The Sant'Anna School of Advanced Studies in Pisa, Italy, is developing an underwater drone 2 meters long that will bore through ice from below with a heated pipe and start pumping up water through it. In renderings, it looks like a folding pocket knife with a pipe instead of a blade. Real ice hopes to test a prototype this year, says co-CEO Andrea Ciolini, an Italian computer scientist and investor who joined the company in 2022. The plan is to thicken 100 square kilometers of sea ice in winter 2027 to 2028 to demonstrate the technique to governments and investors. The approach verges on the fantastic. A swarm of 500 drones would melt holes in minutes and pump water as their infrared cameras monitored the progress. Technicians on a floating or onshore hub would swap out the drones' batteries, plugging the old ones into chargers powered by wind turbines or by green hydrogen or ammonia brought in by ship. Tapping into electricity from Canada's Nuvent region would contribute to climate change because most of it is generated from diesel fuel. The ultimate goal of thickening 1 million square kilometers of sea ice would take an estimated 500,000 drones, which would consume 2 terawatt hours of electricity and require 20,000 people to service them, according to rough math Ciolini has done. The cost would be $10 billion annually. The drones would vastly exceed the 3,800 Argo robot sensors circulating in oceans worldwide, and drone experts say a revolution in battery technology would be needed. How much global warming could be countered through sea ice preservation depends on numerous variables affecting sunlight and melt dynamics. Preserving 1 million square kilometers of sea ice for one additional summer month would cool Earth as much as removing 930 million metric tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere over 20 years, Real Ice estimates. For these results, $10 billion is actually cheap, Ciolini says, and the cooling would be immediate. Capturing that much CO2 from the air with existing machines would currently cost at least $465 billion. For perspective, humanity emits 910 million tons of CO2 every 8 days with no end in sight. Thickening sea ice is a band-aid. While you cure the patient, the planet properly, Ciolini says. Every day in Cambridge Bay, after 3 or 4 hours of flooding, the team used an ice axe to hack each pump out of its hole. Fat white frost flowers formed on top of the solidifying surface. The speed of the freeze was striking, but so was the immensity of the frozen plain stretching to the horizon. It was hard to envision hundreds of thousands of drones popping through the ice day after day, all winter long, for decades. The only highway in Cambridge Bay is the sea ice. In winter and spring, Inuit residents snowmobile hundreds of kilometers over it to go ice fishing and hunt muskox and seals, local hunter Brandon Langan told me in his living room, a black muskox hide hanging behind him. He works part-time for Real Ice, flying airborne drones to monitor the thickened ice reflectivity. When the ice recedes in summer, the Inuit fish the Arctic char that run into the bay from lakes and streams. When ice returns in fall, they hunt the caribou that cross it to the mainland. 2 out of every 3 meals are fish or game. Sea ice to us, it's life, Langan said. It helps us get our food. It gives us our clothing. Now hunters who are used to start moving onto the ice in October have to delay until December. A few have even fallen through. In spring, the ice cracks and melts sooner. Ice loss has diminished the local caribou herd by 90%. The animals go hungry waiting to cross, and when bottled up for too long on the shore, they're easier prey for wolves. Hundreds of caribou have drowned after breaking through the ice. One hunter who had previously been a guide for Real Ice told me at the cultural center in the high school library that he hopes ice thickening could rejuvenate game populations. Inuit insights are vital. Throughout history, scientists and explorers often ignored indigenous knowledge of the Arctic. The last time anyone saw the Franklin expedition was when Inuit hunters encountered starving sailors dragging a lifeboat across the ice in Washington Bay, clad in wool rather than furs. Franklin was dead, and the remaining explorers traded the Inuit beads for seal meat. They apparently didn't know how to hunt seal themselves. Later, native people found mutilated bodies farther south, indicating the explorers had resorted to cannibalism. Charles Dickens dismissed these reports, which were later confirmed as the wild tales of a herd of savages, and suggested the Inuit had slain Franklin's men. This colonial mindset would persist as the Arctic came under government control. Canada and Alaska took indigenous children, including some from Cambridge Bay, away to be re-educated in abusive residential schools where thousands died. A week after I met with Langan, I talked with Inuit Circumpolar Council International Chairwoman Sarah Olsvig, who has spoken out against testing the seabed curtain idea in her native Greenland. She says governments need to start regulating geoengineering, and researchers need to seek the free, prior, and informed consent of local communities. When somebody claims, "We need your piece of land in the name of a greater good," that's exactly what happened when they were colonized, Olsvig says. Real Ice obtained permits from Nunavut's Inuit government as well as the Cambridge Bay Hunters and Trappers Organization. Ciolini says the operation will shut down if ice thickening proves ineffective or damaging. Although the company may patent its drone technology, its articles of association prohibit it from distributing profits. but it would consider founding a new company with indigenous part ownership if it decided to scale up, Ciolini says. Local elders are hesitant. They gather at the cultural center on weekdays to sew fur boots and mittens and speak to the local language. During a break for black tea and candied Arctic char, I asked three of them about the sea ice thickening. They would be concerned about the drones if Real Ice conducted its 100-square-kilometer demonstration, a key step to scaling up, in the strait near Cambridge Bay rather than farther north. If they start doing that under the water, we're going to get no more fish, no more seal, no more nothing, says Annie Antiogic, who was born in an igloo on the sea ice in 1940. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Brad with Discover Science. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.